This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. First blue-green algae, now red tide. Florida's waterways are clogged and the beaches are awash with dead marine life. Residents along the Indian River Lagoon in central Florida are all too familiar with the effects of brown tide that caused massive fish kills back in 2016. Well, now beachside residents around the state are mobilizing to clean up the fish littering the shore. So what's behind these blooms? How much do scientists know about what causes red tide and how and why it spreads? We're taking your calls 1-866-338-5252 and your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio, Amy Green, 90.7's environmental reporter. Amy, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
Also joined by Clay Henderson. He is the executive director of the Stetson University Water Institute. Clay, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
And Dr. Tracy Fanera is the program manager for environmental health at the Moat Marine Laboratory. Tracy, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Amy, I want to start with you. Blue-green algae has sort of made headlines in recent years. What about red tide, though? It's kind of something that maybe people haven't been paying attention to so much until this year, and now it's really making its impact felt. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we're seeing red tide really across the states, across the state's coast. On the East Coast, we're seeing red tide from Volusia County down to Miami Beach, with high concentrations in Brevard, Indian River, and St. Lucie counties. In Brevard County, we've seen significant fish kills in Cocoa Beach and Satellite Beach.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, all the way from Volusia to sort of Miami-Dade, but not so much in Volusia County, just little trace amounts there. There's a little bit of kind of dispute, I guess, as to whether that's actually showed up on Volusia beaches at all.
Yeah, Florida Fish and Wildlife is reporting just background amounts in Volusia County.
Now, red tide started out on the west coast, right, and then kind of crept around. What's been the progress of it?
That's right. Red tide is not uncommon in southwest Florida. This year, the algae bloom kind of hopped onto the loop current and drifted around the peninsula's southern tip and up the Atlantic coast. We've also seen red tide in the Florida Panhandle, especially in southwest Florida. This has been just a huge problem. We've seen just hundreds of dead sea turtles, 100 dead manatees, dolphins.
Wait on that. 100 dead manatees?
Yeah, it's been a big problem in southwest Florida and across the coast along the Gulf of Mexico, and we've seen just tons and tons of dead fish washing up on beaches.
And as we know from your reporting from the Indian River Lagoon in 2016, it's kind of a logistical effort trying to clean up all that dead sea life, right? I mean, so these beachfront residents are having to deal with that now themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the Indian River Lagoon here in Brevard County experienced just a terrible fish kill just a few years ago. That's still in the recent memories of many residents who live in that area. So many dead fish associated with that. And with this red tide this year, Brevard County residents have been organizing cleanups of the beaches.
Mm-hmm. So quite a lot of work to do there. What about the impacts to humans in that area? Because it's not just the sea life that are getting affected, right? There are some symptoms that might be associated with breathing in some of the smell. What can people expect?
Yeah, there are real concerns about that. Red tide is associated with respiratory symptoms like scratchy throat and things like that. And then, of course, blue-green algae has been a problem this year in Florida as well, and that's associated with some neurological symptoms and other symptoms as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about red tide and its recent appearance in Brevard County and now even potentially Volusia County too. I want to hear from you. What are you seeing and experiencing if you've been to the beach in some of those areas in recent months or recent weeks even? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can send in your questions and comments on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Maybe thoughts about some things that could be done to try and prevent it or even the cleanup effort. 1-866-338-5252. Dr. Tracy Fanera with the Moat Marine Laboratory, your research teams are looking into this in a big way. Tell me what kind of research is going on, what you don't know yet, and what you are hoping to discover.
Oh, wow. That's a big conversation.
It is.
So what we do know, red tides initiate 10 to 40 miles off the coast of Florida, off the west coast. It is specific to the Gulf of Mexico. Blooms start at the ocean bottom, and with upwelling and currents, they are brought to the surface, and with currents and winds, they are brought onshore. Now, although naturally initiated, and they would be here whether humans were here or not, mm-hmm. if these blooms are close enough to shore to utilize surface water nutrients, they may to sustain or exacerbate. However, Carinia brevis, which is a species commonly known as Florida red tide, they can use over 12 different sources of nutrients. So they're not very picky. They don't need that readily available surface water nutrients. However, of course, they can use that. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is exactly the initiation process. We don't know exactly where they're initiating, and it's likely that it's many places throughout the Gulf of Mexico, and they are microscopic. If you look at a vial of millions of cells of red tide, it can look completely clear.
Huh.
So they are very small. So we do have AUVs that go out into the Gulf of Mexico and tell us when there is a chlorophyll spike, and now we have enhanced our technology to be more specific to Carinia brevis.
Now can I just stop you for a moment there, Dr. Finnerat?
Yeah.
You said AUV. That's like a remote-controlled submarine. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. And it gives us readily available data. It's automated underwater vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So we get that data automatically to our computers so we can do that rapid response mm-hmm. if we do get a chlorophyll spike. Last year we did. We went out on the boat to see if we can actually see that initiation process. It ended up being a different species. However, it was a really, really cool thing. And now that technology is improving, these events and these rapid response events will be, you know, a lot more clear as to, you know, where these blooms are initiating.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that we don't know as of yet is what kind of influence that nutrients coming in has on those existing blooms. And that goes into forecasting, getting better forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think about weather modeling or hurricane modeling and think about all the resources that have gone into hurricane modeling over the years, all the people, energy, funds, and then compare that to red tide, you can see why we don't have as advanced forecasting for red tide as we do for hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
However, that is a main focus moving forward. And with the new initiatives that we're taking moving forward, hopefully that's going to be something that's going to improve in the very short future. Another thing that we're working on is mitigation strategies.
Uh-huh.
So red tide is kind of like wildfires.
I probably should have walked back for a moment, but what exactly is it? Is it a plant? Is it an animal? Is it a combination of both?
Oh, yeah. We should probably start at that. It is a microscopic dinoflagellate. So basically what it means is that it's a tiny phytoplankton that can swim.
Huh.
It has two tails. If phytoplankton gives us 70% of our oxygen, you know, they're worldwide
mm-hmm.
and they're really important for our survival. However, 1% to 2% of those phytoplankton are harmful, and Florida red tide is one of those species. It is specific to the Gulf of Mexico. You might hear red tides all over the world. However, Florida red tide is Carinia brevis and is only found in the Gulf of Mexico and can be taken up the East Coast by that loop current and then the Gulf Stream.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Clay Henderson in here for a moment because, Clay, you've been sort of studying water policy on a pretty broad level for some time now. How much of what you've been working on up until now has been more on the sort of fresh water, and are you having to kind of rethink and consider more about what happens in the coastal waters of Florida now with red tide and also blue-green algae sort of afflicting the beaches?
I would say that the last 5 years, a major part of our focus has been the estuarine system with the Indian River Lagoon. We started seeing harmful algae blooms outbreak beginning in 2011. And then there was mostly blue-green algae, but then we had a brown tide outbreak, which was particularly invasive and resulted in a large number of mortality for birds, fish, manatees, dolphins, and a significant loss of seagrass. So that's been a big focus of our effort. And the brown tide was a surprise because we didn't have you know, we didn't have local scientists that had experience with brown tide. We were having to look elsewhere to try to better understand what had happened. Mm-hmm. We're sort of in the same situation now with red tide. As Tracy and Amy said, this is a it's a natural occurrence in the Gulf. We see these outbreaks from time to time. This one's a little different, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that, but it is highly unusual to see a red tide event on the Atlantic. I've lived within a stone's throw of the estuary for at least five decades, we'll say that, and I think this is only the third time that I can recall that there's been an outbreak. And back to just to clarify some of the things we've learned this week, we did have reports from citizens about possible red tide outbreak in Volusia. Mm-hmm. Fish and Wildlife analyzed samples that came up negative, but there's still concerns about that. We certainly have experienced it in Brevard. Report we heard this week at our Indian River Lagoon Management Conference was not just about the possibility of it coming around through loop current, but also that it was being tracked, you know, coming through the St. Lucie River, and the concentration of it was pretty. It's probably the strongest near the outfall of the St. Lucie River. It sort of broke up from that point, and it's been sort of spotty as it's come ashore everywhere from Dade County all the way up to Brevard. So everybody's looking at this, and yeah, they're all, I'm sure, I guess that's probably the next question is, what do you do about it, and what kind of policies do we address? But this is a highly dynamic time, and we're all having to experience different kinds of outbreaks and extent and duration that we haven't seen, and I can't recall ever seeing it like this.
Clay Henderson is the director of the Stetson University Water Institute. We're also joined by Tracy Finero, Dr. Tracy Finero, Program Manager for Environmental Health at Moat Marine Laboratory, studying red tide and its impacts, and Amy Green, 90.7's health reporter, environmental reporter rather, although I guess there is some health impacts to the study of or the stories about red tide and blue-green algae too. I want to hear from you as well. What are you seeing? What are you kind of experiencing if you've been down to the beach in some of these areas we're talking about on the southwest coast, and now over onto the Atlantic side with red tide and, of course, blue-green algae in the last couple of years. Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Send us your questions and comments on Twitter too. We're at WMFE Orlando. Amy Green, you made a trip down to Stuart, Florida a couple of years ago too to talk about and talk to some of the people involved in cleaning up after blue-green algae. Just refresh our memories. What was that experience like? But is it kind of a visceral thing, right, to see and smell and kind of see what's going on with blue-green algae?
That's right. This blue-green algae, it's just a terrible problem, and I'm sure there are listeners who would rather not want their memories refreshed on this subject. But yes, when these blooms occur, they're just terrible. They smell just terrible, just, you know, very, very strongly like excrement. And it's very unpleasant to be out on these waterways, which are such a significant draw for our state as far as tourism and residents, population growth, economic growth.
And some of the people you talked to, I was looking back to some of the stories you'd reported back in 2016, they were saying, we are considering getting out of here. We're sort of thinking we might have to move because this thing is so bad.
There are very real economic worries associated with these harmful algae blooms. And, you know, perhaps I should just clarify, red tide and blue-green algae are two separate species mm-hmm. of algae. Red tide occurs in salt water, of course, and blue-green algae occurs in fresh water. And this blue-green algae, you know, we saw kind of a repeat of this year. And this was a situation that began in Lake Okeechobee and spread to coastal estuaries after pulses of fresh water were released from mm-hmm. Lake Okeechobee through the St. Lucie River and the Caloosahatchee Rivers on each side of the coast.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Finera with the Moat Marine Laboratory, I want to bring you back into this conversation because you were talking before about some mitigation things that you are studying. When you talk about you know, something like red tide, which has been around for a very long time, since, you know, before humans, it sort of does its thing whether we're here or not, but there are some things that could potentially exacerbate the effects of red tide. What about trying to clean it up or fix it? Is there anything that you've sort of identified that might help to fix that at this point in time?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, red tide, they are a natural occurrence. Some scientists hypothesize that red tide basically resets the ecosystem. You know, it seems like it kills everything, but it doesn't. Phytoplankton community remains that is hypothesized to be the cause of the bounce back, getting rid of invasive or exotic species, for example. So just like wildfires, they kind of need to happen. They're part of the ecosystem. But when they got out of control, that's when humans intercede. The question is, how do humans intercede before the red tide without causing any long-term effects to the ecosystem? And so we are looking at a number of different mitigation strategies to determine what's effective, but yet what will not cause those long-term effects. So we're vetting options right now. We're going to move forward with three. We're doing a laboratory study and then mesocosm, which is just a small-scale test, basically. Mm-hmm. And then we'll test in a canal way if an option does prove to be non-invasive. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we have in store. But, however, you know, if there is any impact or exacerbation that is being done from human impact, from urbanization and fertilizer runoff, septic systems, et cetera, there are things that we can do at home right now to help alleviate cyanobacteria blooms mm-hmm. and some of the impacts to Florida red tide. And that's disconnecting our impervious surfaces, using native species, not watering during the rainy season, not using fertilizer. And I know some counties are already on board with this by banning the sale of fertilizer during the rainy season, which mm-hmm. is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and in fact, if you drive around Brevard County, sort of alongside areas near the Indian River Lagoon, from time to time you'll see somebody's front yard. They've got a little sign saying, I've got a lagoon-friendly lawn. It might not look quite as yep. kind of emerald green and billiard ball smooth as lawns that people might want, but that might be better for the lagoon in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, we don't live in Connecticut, and we don't have winters killing the grass and then baby grass growing back, and we have a different species of grass here. So it's just unrealistic to have that kind of image of what you think your lawn should look like.
Mm-hmm. I want to get a call in now. We've got Anita calling in from the Everglades. Anita, what's on your mind thinking about this subject?
Good morning. Yeah, my question was, what effect is red tide having on the Everglades? And if it is impacting, what are we doing about it?
That's a great question. Thanks, Anita, for your call. Appreciate that. Amy Green, you want to take that one because you're kind of looking into the Everglades. This is one of your areas of focus, stories you're writing, et cetera. Tell us what's going on down there.
Well, red tide, again, is a saltwater algae, and the Everglades is a freshwater ecosystem. But what we are seeing, just this week, President Donald Trump signed into law Water Resources Development Act, and this is a large piece of legislation. It authorizes spending on water projects across the country, and one of the projects included in this legislation is a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee for Everglades restoration. And one of the things this reservoir will help with are these blooms of blue-green algae by bringing back a more historic flow of water south through the Everglades rather than east and west from Lake Okeechobee to these coastal estuaries, which are very harmed by these flows of fresh water. The flows of fresh water impact wildlife and the ecosystem itself, and they also bring with it blue-green algae, which is also damaging to these estuaries.
Mm-hmm. Clay Henderson, if I could bring you back in for a moment. I mean, the piece of legislation signed into law by the president, it's got a lot of money set aside for that reservoir. The state legislature has also taken some action, especially after the blue-green algae outbreaks in 2016. Do you feel like enough has been done at the state level, at least, to put money into research, into mitigation efforts? What's going on there?
Well, yes and no. I'd say not enough money, because it's a huge amount, and we haven't actually gotten our heads around that number yet. And we certainly are. We're happy that the Congress. I guess the good news is we're getting close to an election, so it is interesting to see the amount of attention that this is getting. From elected officials, which is good, and we hope that it continues after the election. Water Resources Development Act, as Amy said, this project has been authorized now. We still have an appropriations process to go through, but all signs are positive that that will take place. Mm-hmm. On the state level, again, we've got a few issues. Most of the attention for the blue-green algae and impaired waters has been associated with springs. It's a very similar problem, lots of septic tanks, lots of nutrients in the system. And so the legislature and governor have focused dollars on springs restoration, not so much with the estuaries. We have not had dedicated sources of funds for estuarine restoration efforts. There have been a few bills that have been put in the legislature the last few years, but they had not been successful. The legislature has earmarked dollars for Everglades restoration, springs, and beach renourishment, and actually a few million dollars for Lake Apopka, but have not yet taken a step toward the necessary estuarine legislation. We hope that goes forward. At the same time, there have been challenges associated with the appropriations process with Amendment 1 that was approved by the voters overwhelmingly back in 2014, but not a lot of money has gone toward land conservation. But at least as it was reviewed at the trial court and now it's on appeal, whether they can spend that money on restoration is now in doubt. And that's a multi-billion dollar concern that many of us have. On the other hand, I would say that we've had some significant cooperation from the state and dealing with some of these water quality problems with the lagoon. Just last week, DEP said that they would not allow local governments, at least in our case, Volusia County, to attempt to lower water quality standards at a time when we really need to be increasing that. So that's a good thing. And then one last thing. I mean, it's not I have to take my hat off to Brevard County. Voters there 2 years ago approved a sales tax increase, which will generate $300 million toward restoration efforts of the Indian River Lagoon. And that's quite a program. And it's science-driven, and they're moving forward and making some progress.
One final question for you, Dr. Tracy Finera. We had a tweet from a listener saying, do these algae have some kind of natural predator, a kind of snail or something that isn't an invasive predator? I mean, that sounds like a bit of a silver bullet solution, but could there be something like that out there that you just haven't found yet?
So we are looking at species, not so much predation. We haven't found anything like that, but we have found certain species that have an allelopathic impact or impediment on Florida red tide, and macroalgae is one of them, and there are a few other species that we're actually working with right now that have that same kind of impact, and we're trying to see, and they are native species, so we're trying to see what we can do about that. As far as the macroalgae, what we're starting to do is have biofiltration using bivalves like oysters and mussels that filter out. We know that they accumulate the toxins, so therefore they are removing it from the water column. Mm-hmm. We're using them and these structures, which also attract that macroalgae, as a mitigation strategy for canalways. Mm-hmm. Now, they work really well up to a certain point. As soon as the concentrations start getting to tens of millions of cells per liter and the dissolved oxygen content decreases because of all the decaying organic matter, they don't survive. However, they are great for that low, medium, and the beginning of high counts of Karenia brevis.
Dr. Tracy Finera, we're going to have to leave it there, but she is the Program Manager for Environmental Health with Moat Marine Lab. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Also joined by Clay Henderson, Executive Director of Stetson University Water Institute. Clay, thanks as well.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And Amy Green, 90.7's environmental reporter, thank you.
Very nice talking with you.
Still to come, Justin Cirillo moved to Florida for a career in ice. Yes, really. Meet one of the Zamboni drivers for the Orlando Solar Bears. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Fall's finally here, and for some Floridians, it's also the start of hockey season. For Justin Cirillo, hockey's also his livelihood. He's a managing partner at Daytona Ice Arena, and one of his roles is keeping the ice in good shape. He's the Zamboni driver.
It's quite a few different hats I wear here, managing the facility as a whole, working on advertising and sponsorship. But I'm also very involved in the operations, day-to-day operations, including ice maintenance and coaching. I love to coach the kids, and I also ref a lot of our youth and adult league games.
You grew up as a hockey player as well?
I did. I grew up in Salt Lake City. I picked up the sport around the age of 10, and so that was about 1983. I grew up playing all the way up through high school and moved out to Florida here, not thinking I would have a career in the sport, but the way things kind of played out, I ended up being the general manager at the RDV Sportsplex for 8 years. The Daytona Ice Arena had closed in late 2013, and I thought it was a perfect opportunity to give it a shot as an entrepreneur and reopen it up under a new management.
It is kind of counterintuitive to think of coming to Florida and, you know, having a career as a ice hockey rink manager, right?
Yeah, absolute irony, right? But the thing is I think a lot of people don't realize how big ice and ice sports are here in Florida. You have so many transplants. Florida has just boomed in popularity, and where are people moving from? They're moving from New York and Boston and Canada. So we've got at least, I would say, 12 rinks in the state. We have two NHL hockey teams. We've got multiple pro teams at the ECHL level with the Jacksonville Icemen and the Orlando Solar Bears. Figure skating, hockey, curling are very big right now.
And I know RDV has a curling league. I see the curling...
The house.
I see it's laid out there in front of us. Back to hockey, though. Why do you think Orlando doesn't have an NHL team?
Well, I think a lot of it's timing. You've got some very big cities in Miami. You've got very big cities and populations that can support an NHL team in Tampa. Orlando is a quickly growing city, but I think if things had worked out a little bit differently, they may have had a shot at an NHL franchise. But Tampa and Miami just got there quicker. Population was there quicker. But we have a ravenous fan base in Orlando. Orlando Solar Bears, the second iteration that we have now, have blown up nicely. They've caused the youth hockey explosion in Orlando also. And we felt some of that here in Volusia County.
And speaking of hockey, one of your roles is you are in charge of the ice for Solar Bears games, right? What does that involve?
Yes, I'm one of several drivers for Orlando Solar Bears games. The Amway Center has an incredible crew. They're a world-class facility, and it's so nice to be able to have an ECHL team playing in that building. We've got an engineering crew that does a phenomenal job keeping the ice cold. Generally, the ice will remain in most of the year. We used to take it out at certain periods of time when the circus would come to town. We would have to take the ice out, usually during the off season. Luckily, hockey and basketball kind of run in the same season, so the ice stays underneath. We disassemble the boards, put the basketball court up with a barrier in between the ice and the Orlando Magic court, and that crew does an amazing job overnight completely transforming that arena for a concert to a hockey game to a basketball game and back to a hockey game again. I'm one of a couple drivers. We go out, and before the game, we make sure the ice is smooth and fast. You'd be amazed to see how professional hockey players can carve up that ice. So our job is to make sure that we fill in those gaps, we make that ice smooth and fast and ready for the game.
How do you do that?
Well, we use a machine that's called an ice resurfacer, most commonly known as a Zamboni. And this machine drives out onto the ice. It does the work of what used to take 5 or 6 people 90 minutes to manually scrape the ice with brooms and shovels and then go out on the ice with hoses and flood the ice. It takes that all down to a window of 15 minutes. It's got a blade on the machine, a tank filled with water, and that giant razor blade essentially scrapes that ice smooth and lays down a fresh layer of water, filling in those gaps, cleaning that ice surface and making it ready to play, like I said, in just a matter of 15 minutes.
So growing up, watching hockey games and playing hockey, did you ever imagine that you would one day be the Zamboni driver?
It is definitely a lifelong dream. I actually left a very lucrative job and to drop everything and drive a Zamboni. And honestly, it was still, I've been driving now for 12 years. It's fantastic. They say that there's just a couple things that people will stop and look at, and one of them is a Zamboni driving in circles around the ice. So it's fun. It's nice to be part of the crowd, part of the game environment, and just know that you're contributing to incredible sport.
So it takes about 15 minutes. What are you thinking about while you're out there? Is it sort of a bit zen-like in the midst of all the hubbub after the skates have stopped carving up the ice?
It is, but you're actually multitasking quite a bit. You've got not only the blade that you're adjusting as you go across the ice surfaces, you're controlling your water. Not only one water tank, but two. You've got a wash water tank that helps clean the ice and help create that slush that you're picking up with the blade. You have a second water source, which is your hot water source, that you're putting down behind you. And then in addition to that, you're steering in very tight quarters. So between the blade, the water, and the steering itself, you've got a lot going on. So we try and smile at the crowd and wave as much as we can, but at the same time, we're doing a lot of work in that short window.
And there's different kinds of ice you need for different things. Like there's a couple of figure skaters practicing out here at the moment. What kind of ice do they need, and how does that differ from a hockey game?
Yes, the figure skaters, they definitely like a softer ice in general than hockey players. The nice part about ice that most people don't really know about is we can adjust that temperature. We can kick that temperature down in the range of 17 to 19 degrees and make that hard, fast ice that hockey players love. We can kick that temperature up to 25, 26 degrees to a little bit of a softer ice surface that figure skaters like for their edges, for their spins, for their jumps. So the ice surface is, the playable surface can be very dynamic in that sense.
Do you ever just kind of get out there and practice a bit yourself when there's no one else around, like get your skates on and go for a bit of a skate?
I do. The irony is now that I'm a rink owner, I probably skate less than I ever have in my life. But when I do, I'm a member of the Orlando Curling Club, so I try and curl whenever I can. We've had two big tournaments out here in the last year. I play regularly in our men's league, so I try and get out at least once a week for that. And again, back to the coaching and the reffing, I just really enjoy being around the youth aspect of the games and as an official.
All right, do you want to show me the Zamboni?
Let's take a look.
The Zamboni sits in a garage just off the rink. So that's it?
That is it, yes.
That is quite a bit bigger than what I was expecting.
Yes, it's about the size of a large, SUV, a larger SUV, but it's a very heavy machine. It holds a lot of water. It's got this unique apparatus on the back, which is called the conditioner, and the conditioner really does most of the work. This is the genius of this machine that Frank Zamboni invented. He owned a ice-making plant in Paramore, California. Of all the places you would think where a Zamboni would be invented would be in California, but it was there, and he needed a machine that would allow him to get more people on the ice and not have to worry about an entire crew of time taking to prepare that ice. So inside this conditioner are augers, large augers that will collect the snow as the machine drives over the ice. An 8-foot razor blade, very, very sharp razor blade, sits on the back of that conditioner. We go through probably about 2 blades a month. We take it out to a special company that does the sharpenings for us, but it's very similar to the razor in a razor that you would use on your face, the exact same shape, those thin razor blades. That conditioner, using hydraulic pressure, drops down onto the ice, and the operator can change the pitch of that blade to pull up more or less ice, depending on how deep of a cut that they need to do. And those augers collect that snow, pull it up a vertical auger, and dump it into this giant collection area here that holds that snow. And most drivers, if they're doing a deep cut, will fill that entire tank with snow. You're talking about a rink that's 200 feet long, 85 feet wide, so that's 17,000 square feet of ice that you're resurfacing.
It's a lot of snow.
It is a lot of snow. It makes some great snow piles in Florida.
Cirillo starts the Zamboni and we go for a spin around the rink. With the augers grinding away at the ice, it's quite noisy.
What do you do with the leftover snow? You build something, have a snowball fight?
We love making snowmen, yes, but we do have a dump pit that is in the Zamboni room, and that allows us to dump the frozen water in, and then we can recycle that if we need to.
Justin Cirillo is a managing partner at the Daytona Ice Arena and one of the Zamboni drivers for the Orlando Solar Bears. So next time you're watching a game of hockey, think about this. That puck might not be flying around the rink so quickly if Frank Zamboni hadn't invented his ice resurfacer, modified jeeps and water tanks, a giant razor blade, and a lot of pressure. Still to come on Intersection, we revisit a performance from singer-songwriter Kaylee Honeycutt. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Kaylee Honeycutt released her debut album, Sunny Florida, in 2017. Her band, formerly Baby, now Honeycutt, is based in Boston. Honeycutt stopped by WMFE Studios in October last year to play a couple songs. This is a track called If I'm Sorry off Kaylee Honeycutt's album, Sunny Florida.
I'm sorry, I can't tell myself when to get up and make coffee, think I need some help. I can't tell you if I'm better, no, I cannot tell if anything is going right, I think I need some help. How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? I won't see the side of things. Trying to help myself push past all the things I tell that they should never tell. I can't tell you if I'm happy. I can't even tell if anything is going right. I think I need some help. How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? I won't go back. No, it's okay.
That's Kaylee Honeycutt with a track called If I'm Sorry. It's on her debut album, Sunny Florida, and it's also featured in a Pulse benefit compilation.
They had reached out to artists to put out unreleased music, so that song that I just played, If I'm Sorry, got put out a year before the record got put out. And it was really important to me because I lived a couple streets down. I'm an artist in the community, and I think in the DIY community, we're kind of hand-in-hand with the LGBT community. I was really happy that we all banded together and tried to do a couple things, whatever we could, to raise some money. So we did that. I put my song on the benefit CD, and Ugly Orange, our first show actually was a benefit show for Pulse, and we raised a couple $100s, which was really cool.
Mm-hmm. So that song means quite a lot to you.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite song I've ever written.
So tell me about Sunny Florida.
Well, Sunny Florida, I recorded here. It's my debut album. I recorded it with my friend Riley Corcoran, who plays in the band Death Trimmers. And yeah, it was a lot of fun recording it. I was kind of just exploring my songwriting and trying to kind of solidify it. So I decided to try and put the record together. And yeah, it's really good. And it has a lot of my feelings about Florida. So that's why it's called Sunny Florida.
Mm-hmm. There's something more to the title than it's not just all about the sunshine and the good times though, right?
No, Sunny Florida is kind of like a sarcastic like kind of thing, you know, because when you're from Florida, you don't live in the touristy part that everyone knows where it's like, come visit beautiful, sunny Orlando, Florida. You know, like you live on East Colonial, you live on 50. It's like you live by like old rundown shops. Yeah, it's not what everyone thinks it is.
So tell me about the name Baby. Where does that title come from?
I'm the youngest in my family. I got four older brothers, and I cried a lot growing up. It's very emotional, and they like to pick on me, and I turned to songwriting to kind of express myself, and so it seems fitting.
So when did you first start writing music?
Well, I mean, I used to make up songs and sing them to my mom since I was a little kid, but I started writing with an instrument in ninth grade.
And so you also perform in a band, right?
Yeah. So I moved up to Boston last year after I signed to Yellow K Records and put a live band together. I wanted to kind of be afforded the opportunity to tour and literally be able to afford it. I couldn't find a good job down here, and I landed a good job in Boston, and the music scene up there is mm-hmm. awesome. So yeah, I put a live band together up there, and they're really great.
Before you moved to Boston, did you kind of have an idea of what that music scene was going to be like, or was it a revelation to get there and just figure out what was going on?
Well, no, I was applying for jobs in Boston and New York, and I was kind of looking at certain places on purpose, and I knew a music writer in Boston, and I had heard a couple of bands that were like really wild, like there's this band called Birthing Hips, and they're so good. A couple of them go to New England Conservatory for Music. A couple of them, I don't know if one of them went to Berkeley, and then one of them is just like self-taught, but they have a really wild sound. And so there's like a lot of cool bands there that I was hearing that were really unique. And so I was just kind of excited to get in the scene.
Do you feel like your music has changed since you got up there and been exposed to different sounds?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm excited. I'm starting to demo out songs for the next record. I'd probably be a little less surfy. Still kind of same core songwriting, you know, it's mm-hmm. still me, but just different vibe, I guess.
Now, the surfy element, as you say, is that because you grew up in Florida, or is it just what you were listening to as you developed your sound, your voice?
I think both. I mean, I listened to a lot of different artists. I went through a lot of different phases when I was learning how to play guitar and do songwriting, and I was into, like, you know, bluegrass and Americana, and then, like, rock, and then pop, and I was in, like, a synth pop band, and I did a lot of different things, I mean, at the time, I was listening to current indie rockers like Mitski, Frankie Cosmos, and just like the younger female songwriters who were on the come up, and was very influenced by them.
What's the audience like up in the Boston area for the kind of music you play?
Well, I mean, there's like 30 colleges within like such a small radius, so it's definitely a college town. It's really young people. It's really cool because there's two really good music schools there, but then there's also, you have people from MIT who are doing like noise projects, and they know how to like build their own pedals and like build these contraptions with like wires, and then they meet up with the Berkeley students who are like amazing at guitar, and you just kind of get a lot of really unique sounds because you have, everyone in my band is from a different place. Like, Boston is all transplants, college kids. Like, my bass is from LA, my guitarist is from South Korea, my drummer lives in Connecticut, and I'm from Orlando. So it's like, mm-hmm. all the bands are so cool up there because everybody's bringing in different influences.
Well, Kaylee Honeycutt, thank you so much for coming in and performing for us.
Thanks for having me.
And to take us out, a track called Home Sweet Home.
Chair with two legs, that was all that it took to hold me. Me, hole for an eye in my head. I see the people, but they never wave. Alone in the art where I stay with all of the facing my way.
That's Kaylee Honeycutt with a song called Home Sweet Home. And that interview first aired in October 2017. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richberg. Production assistance for this week's show from Amy Green, Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualda. Find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play or Spotify. And we're on the NPR One app. Our full silent drive is underway, so if you appreciate hearing Intersection's deeper dive into stories about Central Florida from LG to Zambonis, show your support by making a contribution. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.